Okay, we are recording.
Thank you so much for joining us. Started these off by asking if you just introduce yourself and tell us where you live.
Okay, my name is Kathy Abramite, and I live in Oberlin, Ohio.
Thank you, Kathy. Also here, I'm Ian McMillan. I teach the Anthropology of Europe class, and we also have.
I'm Jacqueline Gaines, and I'm a student in this class.
So you said that you've been doing a little bit of research. Maybe you could tell us what you've been researching.
Do you want me to start with that, or do you want me to start with learning about the Roma history in my family? I mean, should I start with at the beginning of learning about this? Or?
I would like for you to back up.
Okay, I think that's the interesting thing. So growing up, my grandmother, her first husband died, and I'm not really sure why. As a child, we were all.
May I pause you for just a second and ask,
sure.
Growing up where?
Growing up in Sandpoint, Idaho.
Great, thank you.
Okay. And her first husband died mysteriously. That's what we were told. And as a child, in my mind, I thought that meant like, you know, a couch fell on him or, I mean, something odd, you know, something very strange. And then shortly thereafter, she married again. So I had aunts and uncles with the last name Lutsky. And then my father and his brother had the last name Abramite. And so I knew that there was an Abramite husband in there somewhere. And I knew that he left shortly after my father was born. This must have been in the, I would guess, the late 20s. And I knew that my grandmother did not like him. She referred to him as a goat, which was, I think, the equivalent as, you know, us calling somebody a really bad, you know, asshole kind of term. So he was a goat in her mind. And so I grew up knowing that he was absent. And then, you know, we're marching along, and she always told us, you're German, you're German. We're marching along, you know, I graduate high school, I go on to college, and I should say that I'm first generation. My father, I think, went through ninth grade, and I don't know what my mother's educational background was. Her mother died in childbirth, and so she was raised in an orphanage in Montana. So I don't know. I know she didn't graduate high school, but I don't know if she ever went to high school or if it was only elementary school. So I graduate high school and I go off to college, which is completely foreign in my family. And, you know, graduate college, go on to graduate school in musicology, then do graduate work in library science. And so fast forward to moving to Oberlin, which would be 1992 was when we moved here, and our oldest daughter was an infant when we came. So my job here is I'm the reference librarian in the conservatory library, and I was sitting at the reference desk, and I had my nameplate with my name, Kathy Abramite, on the front of it, and a faculty member from the German department walked in and walked up to the desk to ask me a question, and he said, "Ooh, gypsy woman," and I said, "What? What is that?" And he said, "Oh, Abramite, that's a gypsy name." And I was baffled. I said, "Oh." And he said, "Go back and read the short stories of Siegfried Lenz." And so I did. And then I find out that there's this, as he calls it, a gypsy clan that adopted the name Abramite. Anyhow, that's what the German history professor told me. So that must have been, I don't know, early 2000s maybe? Maybe it was a little before that, that it was ever planted that maybe there was more to this German story. And so I started doing a little research, mostly reading those short stories, and like looking at pictures of Roma, and having this really strong reaction, like, oh, those feel like my people. Mostly, interestingly, looking at the photos on the Holocaust Museum memorial site, and seeing facial features of my siblings, and I should say on my mother's side, Irish, a little German, Native American, and on my father's side, like I said, I thought German. So these faces started looking really familiar to me. And at that point, I was really interested in shamanism. And so I became very interested in Roma shamanism and sort of started looking at why is it that spiritually I've not really found a place that feels like home. I mean, I was raised Catholic, but that didn't really feel... So it kind of came into this sort of deep place of identity and knowing and not really being sure, you know, sort of who I am. And so, you know, we march forward. Oh, there's one story, though, that I should go back to. When I was in high school, some people showed up at our house from Denver, and I don't know how they found us, and they said, we're related. Your grandfather, Fred Abramite, is our grandfather also. So I went and I got, right? Went and I got my, I was very, very close to my grandmother, and my mother was like, go get grandma. So grandma only lived like two houses down from us. So I go to grandma's house and I say, grandma, they say they're related to us. And she was always a very proper woman. You know, she always wore a hat, always a dress and a brooch. And she, you know, she got herself looking nice, and she came to the house, and she asked me to sit next to her, and she began quizzing these people from Denver. And when she knew that it was a match was when she said, what did Fred do for a living? And they said he was a cheesemaker. And he was a cheesemaker. And she knew right then from the stories and the cheesemaker that when he left her in the mid-20s, he did a fair amount of traveling around, and now we have these relatives in Denver as well. And I'm sure there are others. I'm sure there are others. I'm sure he had multiple families. So that's where that all came to. And then with the rise of Ancestry.com, I'll skip to the current research project. I started digging around and looking for information on him and my grandmother. And there's so much more information available even today than there was, say, 3 years ago when I started looking for information on him. What I found was actually quite a bit. That he came to the United States in 1890. On this document, the manifest from the boat he came over on, it says that he was Russian. We were always told German. I don't know who identified him as Russian. At that point, I mean, I don't know if he did or I have no idea, but there's this Russian potential. He was 17 when he came over, and that at that point he called himself, he identified himself on this manifest as Ferd Abramite. So he's marching along, and I found his World War I draft registration card, and at that point he uses a different name. He refers to himself as Friedrich, Friedrich. And that's
awfully German.
Yeah, and that 1874. But who knows, somewhere in here I saw that he had like a third grade education. Again, I have no idea if he just said he had some education, and because he could speak, they said third grade. Because my grandmother couldn't read, so I don't know what they would say about her education.
What was the 1874?
1874.
His birth year or?
Yeah. Here they say 1874, and this one says 1873. But as I follow him through a little further, they aren't very exact. Then he marries my grandmother in 1920 after her first husband passed away, and they have two sons, Edward Abramite in 1921, and then my father, Albert C. Abramite, in 1925, and then he bolted. And I see some documents my grandmother says he was dead, and other documents she says he was divorced. So at that point, she, you know, here she is with kids from the first marriage, the Lutsky kids, and now these two Abramite boys. And as she would tell me this story, she would say, I had two choices. I was an unskilled woman with five children, and I could either become a prostitute or I could become a bootlegger. So at that point, she started bootlegging. Now, she never called herself a bootlegger. She called herself a distributor. And so she wore long skirts, and she used to tell stories about tying the ropes under her skirt and tying the bottles to either side, a bottle on the left, a bottle on the right. And she'd, you know, walk through town with the long skirts and the bottles under there. A couple of times she was arrested. Once when the bottles clanked together and broke. The police showed up at the house, and it was corn whiskey. The police showed up at the house, and my father didn't want her to be taken away to jail again. So there was a pitcher of whiskey. The barrels would be dumped into her basement through a side door on the basement, which was the same house that I played in, you know,
In Sandpoint.
And there was on the side of the house, there was a door, a special lift, and you could shove a barrel down there. So she did all the bottling, the receiving of the alcohol in that side door, and then she'd bottle and then take it around town. And at one point she was bottling, and she had a pitcher of corn whiskey, which apparently, my dad always said, it looked like red Kool-Aid, that she was pouring in the bottle. The police showed up, and so he just walked over and put it in a glass with ice and drank it so that they wouldn't know. She was not taken to jail that time. But she must have done well financially, because that's the only job I ever heard her talk about ever having. And she owned her home. She was a very proper woman. Lutsky was really a very proper man. She, in those days, you know, before she married the Roma man, in those days, she had the fox fur collar, and she always wore gloves in a person. And then when she was left with these kids, I have no idea how she found Fred. You know, if he was just in the area, and because she was a widow with three children, she was tainted goods, and, you know, the Roma guy was the best she could do. I'm not really sure. But she was hugely embarrassed. You know, she never ever told us anything about him. She referred to him as a goat. And I don't know if the embarrassment, I tend to think it was twofold. I think it was that, you know, her partner walked out on her and then went and started families elsewhere. But it was also that I think in her mind she married below herself. And so she just never told us. You know, she never told us anything. But some of the documents that I found were really funny. Okay, in the 1930s, okay, so he leaves. My dad's born. Fred, my grandfather, leaves in the late 20s. In the 1930s census, he's in Oregon. And he's in southwest Oregon. And it says in here that his parents are from Germany, and that he's naturalized, and that he's a miner and a machine man. And this is at age 55. And he's living in Grants Pass, Josephine. I think that's Josephine County, Oregon.
It is. I grew up not far from there.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, apparently he got into trouble. Because I found another document that said he owed $200 in back taxes. And at this point, his name on the 1930 census is Frederick, F-R-E-D-E-R-I-C-K, Abramite. Then he gets in trouble owing $200 in back taxes in 1935. And he's changed the name on his documents to Fred Rogue River Abramite. And he owed $200 in back taxes, and so he bolted. And this is hilarious. It actually says, Abramite, Fred Rogue River, $200. And that's the Jackson County taxpayer's bill. So he bolts out of Oregon, And he just goes a little bit south, and he ends up in the 1940 consensus. He's in Northern California. And that's where he dies. And at that point, let's see, he had changed his name again to, oh, Frederick Abramite, A-B-R-A-M-E-I-T. And then on his tombstone, his name is Friedrich, F-R-I-E-D-R-I-C-K, last name Abramates, A-B-R-O-M-A-T-E-S. So with every move, every time he moved, he changed his name slightly. And I suspect it was out of necessity. You know, it wasn't, I don't think the traveling lifestyle for him was, you know, just because he liked to travel. I think it was probably necessity that for whatever reason, whether it was, you know, running from the law or running from the responsibility of a family or whatever the reason was, he, with each move, he did a slight variation on his name. And then died in 1946. I found their marriage license online. I found his draft registration for, what would that be, World War I? Is that right? And it says he was a laborer from Germany. Now, interestingly, is it okay if I just keep babbling?
Yes.
Please.
Yes.
Okay. So
my end, please interrupt or
no,
interrupt,
absolutely.
But let us know if you have a question.
So interestingly, so we have one daughter who studied with Ian in gypsy music class, Romani music class. And then our second daughter is a senior here this year at Oberlin, and she's an econ major. And so she really wanted to study last spring at the Warsaw School of Economics. And so we thought it would be great fun to travel over with her and travel for a week and look for some family history. Because the other side of the family, my husband, his name is John Sabin, and my daughters have his last name. John's family is Jewish, and the family name is Saperstein. But his uncle Albert, who's the polio vaccination, invented the polio vaccine,
mm-hmm.
at that point they weren't letting Jews into medical school. And so he changed the name from Saperstein to Sabin.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, he co-opted a famous woman doctor's name, Florence Sabin, right? I mean, so it's only, two generations? So since Florence Sabin had developed the Rocky Mountain fever vaccination, Albert thought, oh, that's a good name. I'm going to take that name. So he changed the family name from Saperstein to Sabin. So when we went over to Poland, and he grew up in Bialystok, they left Poland, out of fear of Hitler and other issues going on in Poland at the time, and came to the United States. So part of this Poland trip was both to sort of look for the roots of John's family and sort of feel and be in that place. But the stories about John's family and the stories that I heard from my grandmother, mostly around the food, they were so similar.
Hmm.
I mean, the same foods. And so we thought, oh, well, let's look for aroma museum or try and find that there too. And since we were going with a fair amount of time to plan, we actually hired a guide. And when the medical college where Albert studied in Warsaw, it was actually in Bialystok, learned that we were coming, they asked to come and if they could interview us. Primarily because, you know, local boy Albert Sabin does good. And the family's here, and there's all kinds of press, and, you know, I mean, it was a big deal, and it was sort of hilarious at the same time, because all of Warsaw is, of course, Catholic. There are no Jews left, and when we, in the interview, said, oh, yes, and my wife has a Romani background, we'd love to hear more about that, the whole room silenced. I mean, even today, there was this huge amount of shame, and they're like, oh, and all of a sudden, the whole experience shifted. I mean, we did get to see more about where Albert grew up, and where the cemetery was, it's no longer a cemetery, it's now a park. And John came away from the trip feeling like, oh, I feel this. I feel where I'm from and I get it. And I understand more about what happened. And both of our daughters felt like, oh yeah, this is our place. But when they shifted to put on the hat of, but what about Mom's side of the family? I don't think John felt it nearly as deeply. I mean, you know, they're not his people. But the three of us, Deani, Brooke, and I, were just sad because we couldn't find anything. Brooke later toured a little bit, did some travel, and she did find a Roma museum. But it was very striking how little we learned and how unsettling the whole thing was. And my two daughters said, I'm never going back. I'm never going back. You know, that's just terrible. I was grateful to be there because it helped me understand more about why my grandmother lied to us. I mean, if there's still shame there today, in 2016, there's still shame. I mean, I can't even imagine what that was like for her. And so at first I felt mad that she lied to us. And then I realized it was really a form of protection from her perspective. I don't think she did us any favors, but I get it. I get why she handled it the way she did, you know. Anyhow, any questions from you guys or anything
yeah,
you want
to
talk
like
about?
I'd like to back up to, you mentioned the food that was really similar. Can you talk about that a little bit? What kinds of foods?
Well, Grandma used to make something, and this may be the Russian thing, because she used to make something called, I thought it was ruble soup. Now, aren't rubles little Russian coins?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the soup was basically chicken stock, and they were essentially teeny, teeny little dumplings, where she would take a bowl of flour and drop an egg in it and stir it until they became tiny little pea-sized dumplings. I guess kind of like little cheap noodles. And, you know, and she would dump them in there. And, I mean, it was definitely poverty food. I mean, it was just, you know, flour and egg and some broth. A lot of cabbage. You know, and that was true with John's family as well. John's grandma made something that we all called nanny cake, which later, I mean, as I was looking for recipes, I don't know what it really was, because of course they don't index anything called nanny cake. But it was this kind of flat, sweet, almost like shortbready kind of thing that she would put jam in and then roll up. And my grandmother did something similar, but she didn't roll it. It was like this flat thing of a cookie, kind of bland. And then she put like raisins in the middle and another layer on top. But the dough felt, you know, the dough was similar. I don't know. My grandmother always made pies. I don't know that was anything in particular to that, you know, that background.
Was something that stood out on holidays or special occasions, you know, that you only brought out special times a year?
Those cookies.
Mm-hmm.
She was a big gardener, and so she did a lot with vegetables. She always had, you know, a basement full of, you know, potatoes and apples, lots of potatoes. She made great wine, really, really good wine. I never had any of the whiskey that she made, but she was a really fine winemaker. And she would do a lot of things like with greens, like dandelion greens and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I don't recall, I recall her pies. She died when I was in college, like my second year. And so most of my time with her was when I was really young. And I was probably the person in the family who spent the most time with her. You know, going down to her house almost every day and hanging out. Very, very frugal. I mean, and she prayed the rosary multiple times a day. She had lots of little tchotchke things. You know, funny little like salt and pepper shakery kinds of things. And she smoked, and she smoked her cigarettes down to the very last little nibbon, you know. She was just extremely frugal. Spiritually, I think she was very connected to the ancestors, but in the Catholic tradition, she wouldn't have called it that. She believed she would frequently pray for the ancestors and pray to be in good graces with them. And she would go to every single, and my father did this too, every single funeral at our church. The whole purgatory thing, I don't know. Sometimes I wondered if she put her belief system, you know, she sort of plugged it in where it would fit in the Catholic tradition. But I don't really know that that was the framework that she was using. You know, was she imposing a belief system and like, oh, purgatory, that's a graceful way for me to be connected to the ancestors, or to stay connected with those who were deceased before and to realize she had a responsibility or a relationship, you know. I don't really get a sense of that. And who knows, when she was holding those beads, if it really was a Catholic thing or not. She was very earth-honoring. Huge, huge garden. You know, most of her yard was a garden. She was a canner. You know, she'd freeze. She'd put, you know, preserve foods. You know, very frugal. Would, you know, cut coupon kind of person, you know.
How long had her family been in Idaho, that part of the country?
Well, when I looked her up, it's interesting. When I looked her up, I see that her father, Bernard Eckel, was born in Germany in 1839. Now, grandma was, according to these records, born in Minnesota. And she would have been born, when was she born? 1844. That's her mother. Here's grandma. Born about 1888. In Minnesota. I have no idea how she got to Idaho. In 1835, she was in Idaho. I think she met Letzky. 1935, yeah. I think she met Letzky in Minnesota. And you know, the funny thing is, there's a student here right now whose name is something like Abramowitz. And I went to her one day and I said, so tell me about your family background. You know, I really wonder if there's a change in your name, and if our names have been changed in some way. Because sometimes I see Abramite as Abernathy, or, I mean, I see all kinds of different. And she said, oh, I'm from Minnesota. And I said, you know, do you think there's any chance that your family background is from a Roma community in the Minnesota area? And she said, oh, my parents are here. I'm going to talk to my dad about it. Well, the dad, you know, completely denied it. I have a feeling, for whatever reason, that there was a community in Minnesota in that time. And it's funny, the student always says, I think you're my long-lost aunt. Because we get email for each other, too. You know, they get our names wrong.
So you said your grandmother was born in 1888, and then Fred, or Friedrich, or whatever his name was, arrived in 1890, right?
To this country?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was 17 when he came over.
So that he was significantly older then as well, which may have had something to do with perhaps that shame element
that
you
could be
mentioned as well.
I wished I would have had pictures to bring to show you, but I only thought of it today. It's really striking if you look at pictures of Grandma when she was married to Letzky, and you know, she's got the fur on and stuff like that.
This was her first husband
died. Yeah. And then the pictures of her with Fred, oh my gosh. You know, it's completely different. very poor, you know, dirty. The pictures of my father from his early days, you know, he's standing there. He must have been like six or something. And there's a photo of him with a gun that he'd gone out hunting, probably, you know, to hunt for food for the family. And of course, in the Northwest, a lot of people hunt. But it was really striking, the difference in the way she looked and the way she cared for herself. The pictures towards the end of her life, she was much more like she was at the beginning. I mean, she wasn't wearing the fox fur stole kind of deal, but, you know, well kept. The gloves, the little handbag over her wrist, the brooch, the whole bit. So this, these pictures in the middle were very striking at how different she looked. Now, I've never done any of that, like, blood testing or anything to see, so what really is going on here? And at first, when the faculty member said that to me, I was curious. I mean, I really don't know for sure. I mean, in my gut, I know. In my gut, I think, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense about the, I won't say deceitfulness. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And then when I find documents like this, and he's calling himself Fred Rogue River Abramite, I mean, whatever, he was definitely a traveler. Now, how that translates, I don't know, you know.
Do you have any desire to recreate any of that Romany custom in your life, or, you know, try to get back to that at all? I mean, you say you feel it in your gut, and I want to know how that manifests in
your
life. Well,
mostly I think it manifests, where I've noticed it the most is spiritually. Mm-hmm. You know, my study of shamanism, my study of and earth honoring practices, that's really where I feel it the most,
mm-hmm.
is more in a spiritual practice than in a spiritual connection, than in, you know, I don't know, a holy day to, I don't know, Kali or whoever,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but who knows? I mean, in time, that could change, you know. But that was the initial kind of entrance. I noticed, like, the Catholic Church piece it never really sat with me. And when I started studying shamanism, and I found the Gypsy Shamanism book, I was like, oh yeah. And so I started doing some of those kinds of practices. So. I don't know where it will go from there, you know.
That tension between, you know, the possibility of DNA or genetic evidence, and one way of kind of thinking about identity as traced back to through certain genetic lines and certain parts of the world from which people have moved, so Roma from Northwest India, what's today Northwest India, versus, on the other hand, you know, talk about traveler and this kind of idea about lifestyle. I feel like in today's society, America, the terms are very confusing for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of kind of what the terms Gypsy and Roma mean around here or around the United States today?
You know, I mean, maybe if I studied more, I'd I don't even know enough to feel like, I mean, I don't know enough to know what terminology is appropriate even. You know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't really feel like I know enough. I know I frequently correct people and feel deeply offended when they say things like, I've been gypped.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just, I'm offended when that kind of, it's romanticized and stereotyped, like in, you know, in shows and opera and, you know, I mean, I find that very offensive. But I don't know about term. I mean, I thought it was interesting when you mentioned the term traveler, and I had never heard that term before. And you know, my introduction was through the term gypsy, and so I don't know. I don't have a strong feeling about that, but I also feel like I haven't done enough study to know, like, well, how should I feel about this? You know, what's the politically correct way to feel about this? You know, does that make me less Roma if I don't know the politically correct terms? Or, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, so, anyhow. I'm sure there is a correctness to it. I just haven't really, I don't know what that correctness is yet, you know, for me. So.
You have a question?
I can't think of another question off the top of my head.
I feel as though I have one, but I'm blanking as well. Did you have anything else that you wanted to say or to share with us, Kat?
I would like for my kids to have a better sense of this. And I know when I was, my daughter Brooke called me after class today, and I told her, oh yeah, you're not gonna believe it. You know, your great grandfather, Fred Rogue River Abramite. And she's like, oh, please save all this. You know, we need to put it together. I have a sister who's a sociologist. And a PhD in sociology, and she's retiring this year from her teaching position. And one of the things that she and I have talked a lot about is that our next, like, project is to try and get a better handle on this. I you know, my siblings, there, when I wrote to them and said, you guys, I don't think we're German as we think we're German, it's like they couldn't really take it in. And maybe Gina, the sociologist, she could. The other siblings, you know, it's funny, identity is just such an odd thing, because they're so deeply wedded to this idea of their identity that it's like they're not willing to, like, crack the world a little bit and look at, so what does that mean? And so I don't really feel like I have a tremendous amount of family support around it. Because it's just easier for them to hold on to what they've been told and what they know. I did feel really, really nervous when Deani, our oldest daughter, was, this must have been when she was in high school. The high school orchestra was going to Italy. And at that point, they were making all Roma register in Italy. And I was like, holy shit. They're gonna take my kid, you know? And so I was like, you know, do not tell anybody. You don't, you know, don't discuss. And I know I was being paranoid, but the fear and the lack of safety was so real. And to have her there without me, you know, I'm like, you just keep your mouth shut, you play your cello, you have fun, you eat lots of gelato, and you don't say anything about who you might be or might not be, you know? But I think that they deserve that. They deserve to know more, you know.
Yeah, I recently read a piece in the New York Times where a woman was struggling with whether or not to do one of those DNA tests because she identified as deeply Irish, you know, did all the St. Patrick's Day things,
yeah,
and made the corned beef and did all this stuff, and she didn't know at the end of the day if she wanted to know. Do you feel like that would change whether you decide to do a test like that or not? If you maybe could,
yeah,
find out that you were or weren't?
Well, you know, it's funny because on a deep level, I feel like I already know.
Uh-huh.
It's funny because when you're sitting at the reference desk, you don't have much choice but to take in the information.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that I could have just, like, oh, you know, silly old German professor, and ignored him. But I let it, you know, I let it seep in. But I let it sit there for a while before I started looking deeper. And I dig around for 6 months, read some Siegfried Lenz stories, and then I'd back away from it. And then lean back in. I mean, I don't know. I don't feel wedded to doing that test. I feel sad that my siblings are so unwilling to explore it with me.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it, though. I mean, it makes, because identity is such a big deal. And it's one thing if you personally have a hunch and you start exploring because of an inner knowing. But it's another thing when somebody else says it to you, and all of it, and you have to pick, like, do I investigate this, or do I just say no, that's silly? And I think that that's probably where they will remain. I know Deani and Brooke don't think it's silly. I mean, they're like, yeah, you know. It's funny, as they talk about like epigenetics and history, they're like, man, this really sucks. You know, a Jewish father and a Roma mom. You know, we are destined to have all kinds of issues, you know. Like, well, the gypsy and the Jew, right? Yeah. You know, so they're much more willing to look at it, you know.
Thank you so much, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate
you're welcome
sharing with us.
Thank you.